Hello, listeners. Thanks for tuning in again. This week, we're lucky enough to have a special guest, Carl Siegling, founder and portfolio manager for the listed investment company, Cadence Capital. And these guys have achieved a 15% per annum return since inception in 2005. Carl and his team are opening a new fund called the Cadence Opportunities Fund, which you can learn more about and apply for the IPO at cadencecapital.com.au, cadencecapital.com.au. And these guys, they have a very unique investment strategy. I think you're going to be able to learn a lot from this episode. They use a combination of fundamentals and technical analysis to generate strong returns in opportunistic stocks. And if this is your first time listening to the podcast, make sure you subscribe to receive episode updates. And if you like this episode or any of the ones before it, be kind and give us an iTunes review. It's free, takes no time at all, and it helps us out a lot. So with that, let's get into the show. I really, really enjoyed this one, and I know you will too. As always, a lot of content here. You will learn heaps. It gets a little technical at times, but push on, and you will be rewarded with some pearls of investing wisdom. And with that said, here is Mr. Carl Siegling. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Seneca Financial Solutions podcast. My name is Jordan Travers. As always, I have here with me Luke Larrative.
Oh, it's been a tough Monday today. It's been a little bit tough.
We've got another guest on the show today. We are graced by the presence of Mr. Carl Siegling from Cadence Capital. How are you, Carl? Welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone.
Good to have Carl on. He's very generous with his time and nice for him to come and tell us a little bit about the lick and what's happening at Cadence and markets. And yeah, we'll talk a bit of rubbish, so it should be enjoyable.
So we'll do a little bit of, well, we probably would have already said a little bit of an intro about who you are, what you do, but just for the little of our listeners, just explain what you're doing at Cadence and what's happening at the moment.
Or sure, two of them, sure. How much?
Yeah. Look, hey, listen, we're Cadence Capital Limited, right? It's a listed investment company. Mm-hmm. It's been listed for 15 years, so we've got a 15-year track record. And, you know, I've been investing in the markets for 25 years. This is I'm coming into my 26th year, so I had my 25-year numbers came last year, and for the listed vehicle 15 years this year. Mm-hmm. And after 15 years we're listing a second company, so this will be our first company is called Cadence Capital Limited. Mm-hmm. And this company is going to be called Cadence Opportunities Fund. And you know, part of the process has been going around talking to people, doing presentations interstate, and you know, there's been a lot of presentations. I think I'm up to about number 54 in presentations, and the team have been doing presentations as well. So there's been a lot of people to visit and a lot of people to talk to.
How many meetings do you reckon you've done in the last 3 weeks or 2 weeks?
Oh, probably 60 Ooh. Meetings. Yeah, a lot of meetings. I mean, look, there is, I've got to say, compared to, I mean, this makes me sound really old, but compared to 15 years ago when I listed, there really wasn't much interest in listed investment companies 15 years ago.
Yeah, right.
And there certainly wasn't much interest in little old Cadence, because nobody knew who we were. Mm. And we really only had a 3-year track record.
Sounds like Seneca.
At that stage. Yeah, so, but you know, 15 years from now, you'll have an 18-year track record. And you know, I said to someone recently at my reunion, in 25 years' time, I'll have a 50-year track record.
Whew.
So hopefully, you know, I'm still able to do it. And I think, look, the good thing about stocks is you can still pick them when you get older.
It's true.
In fact, maybe you get better at it.
Probably get better.
I think it's a good if something you're interested in, it's your hobby and you enjoy it, like it's a pretty good way to earn a living.
Yeah,
like,
it's a great thing to do. I mean, the best thing about really when people ask me like what's the really good part about it is you get to go, just like you're talking to me about my business now, and so we'll probably have to cut off after about 2 or 3 hours because people love talking about their businesses. It's the same for me. When you go and see people, in medium-sized businesses, or medium to what we'd think an individual might think is a large business, like 100, 200, 300 million market cap business.
Yeah.
Those people have, generally speaking, started those businesses, built those businesses, seen good times, seen bad times. They love talking about their businesses. Mm. And you learn a lot.
It's a baby.
You go and visit them and they'll tell you about the industry. They'll tell you about their business. You can go and meet a competitor. They'll tell you about their business. You can go and see an unlisted competitor. They'll tell you about their business. Then you can go see an analyst who works at a broking firm or an advisory firm. They'll tell you about the industry. And when you piece it all together, you actually do over time begin to develop an edge. I mean, you don't get an edge immediately, or your view might not be right immediately. In fact, your perceived view of what a situation is when you walk into a meeting is very seldom that accurate. Mm. So it's really the process of visiting companies. You know, we see probably 700 or 800 companies a year, which really gets you to understand
the time nuances. Series, you know, as well. Like it's you've seen them once and then twice and then the third time, and you're not really mapping what they say at each meeting. It's more the change.
Well, and what's different, and how cyclical. I mean, our business is called Cadence. You know, everything goes in cycles. Mm. So all these businesses are cyclical. Generally speaking, most businesses are cyclical. So the other thing that's important about it, if someone tells you they see 700 companies a year and they just bang out the same 700 companies all the time, or they see them 4 or 5 times a year or 10 times a year, that might not be adding that much value. You're kind of looking for where you're looking for. For us, the most exciting thing is to be looking for something that has bombed out and is imploded, that nobody likes, that's cheap. Or alternatively, the ones I especially like are the ones that everybody loves and are in love with and can't just get their minds off it, and they become so incredibly expensive because of that. And you know, I think we've been in times gone by when we think of the things that, generally speaking, some of our smaller cap and mid cap stocks are not, they're interesting to people, but they're not that well known.
Yep.
When we get involved in a big cap stock where there's this type of thing happening, we get asked about it a lot in the press, and they ask us to be on television, they ask us to talk about it. Why would you be short Domino's Pizza at $75? It's such an amazing company. Or how can you go long Macquarie Bank at $25 after the global financial crisis, when we all know we've just had the global financial crisis and Macquarie Bank is a basket case? Or how can you be short ABC Learning at $5.50 when everybody knows it's the preeminent childcare center, childcare business in the Australasian region? And how can you not like OneTel when everybody knows that it's the best telco company in the sector? Or let's just go on.
OneTel, you're too young, Jordan.
You've just got to go through all the bankrupt stories, or all the stories that have collapsed and then recovered, to realize that it all comes down to valuation. You know, like, how cheap do they get and how expensive do they get?
It's that margin of safety, you know, like, and then when you lose your margin of safety and you go into this margin of speculation, well, that's when your kind of your short ideas start to come to the fore.
Yeah, well, and I think the other thing about just teasing that out a little bit further, I think we're all looking for cheap stocks and looking for expensive stocks, and cheap, that's cheap and that's expensive, and I like to buy low and sell high, and all the fund managers are telling you that, right? But one thing I've noticed over the years is, if you say to someone, okay, here's a cheap stock, now you go and do something with it. And most people don't really not know what to do with a cheap stock. Now, I'm not trying to be, too controversial in that statement. If you give someone a stock on 2x cash flow and then it doubles, or say it goes up 50%, they'll be ecstatic and they'll sell it. And if it doubles, they'll be over the moon and they'll sell it. And there will not be many people in the population that can hang on to a winning position until it goes up 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times.
Mm. We talk about this so much, Carl. You'd be so surprised. Jordan and I talk about this all the time. Like, you can look at all the metrics you like. You can identify all the stocks that you want to, you want to identify. And it's great that you've got the ability to do that. But unless you've done the work, unless you spent the time with the business, unless you understand what you're doing deeply, not just a little bit, you'll never have conviction to hold.
You won't have conviction. That's the thing. I was about to say the same words. You said them first. You won't have the conviction for it. And then the other thing that I'll say on the other side of this, which is the two errors that we very quickly weed out when people come and work with us, but is the reason why we can't hire people readily either, is if people get attracted to a falling stock, there's nothing like a falling stock for people. Like, then their phone rings. So let's just talk about the last 6 weeks, okay? First the market fell, and then this telephone call started by the dips. buy the dips, buy the dips. And then a week later, it's even more fervent, buy the dips, buy the dips, buy the dips. And then so it goes, buy the dips. And that happens for 5 weeks. And then in the 6th week, the phones just go quiet. Because, of course, the buying the dips all the way down hasn't worked.
Of course.
Now, people, they were in a bad situation when they were down 5%. Now they're in a catastrophically bad situation, down at stock 25%. Yeah, yeah. And they've added to it 3 times. Yeah, so we're not allowed to add to falling stocks, and we're not allowed to sell stocks on the way up.
This is the unique thing about Cadence, and I hate professing people's investment strategies, but this is one of the things that Cadence does that probably not many other funds do, is there is a strong kind of focus on technical analysis, on making sure that you're investing with trend. And I suppose maybe you want to explain to, you know, potential investors in the LIC how that's going
to
work.
Well, so what tends to happen is people, they'll look at us and go, geez, you guys are contrarian. That's, I often hear that, and I wrote a white paper on this, and in actual fact, we're not contrarian. You know, if we use that Macquarie example, we waited for Macquarie to fall from $100 to $17, then turn around and go back up 50% before we even started looking at it. With Reckon, they said, oh, you're so contrarian, it fell, and then you bought it at 28 cents, but it had already come up from 12 cents or 14 cents. We gave the first 100% to someone else.
Yeah.
In the last time Melbourne IT tech wrecked, it went to 33 cents. Sorry, it went to 18 cents, then recovered to about 34. Again, we gave the first 100% to someone else before we looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, we're not, thematically, we might appear contrarian, but we're not buying falling stocks. We're waiting for them to turn around to go back up before we scale into them. And it's the two things. This is the thing that I always have to say to new people that join us as well. Doing the fundamentals on their own doesn't help you. Doing the technicals on your own, that's not helping you either. But when the two line up, that's very powerful. Back to your point before, Luke, and that's what gives you the conviction. Because why are you feeling so good about it? Because it's fallen 80% or 90%. It is possible that it's cheap. It's finished falling and going back up again. Why could it recover? It could well be a very good scalable business. Contrary, on the other side, if Domino's, if you thought it was a short at 40 PE, then it went to 50 PE, then it went to 60 PE, then it went to 70 PE, the whole time you're thinking it's more and more and more and more of a short, and then when it does finally roll over, then you at least have some conviction at it because you've been looking at it for 2 years.
Agreed, and I think that's the... like the scaling in thing, I think a lot of people don't get either. And I think it's the averaging up or averaging out of positions, I think, is probably one of the smartest things you can do.
It's hard because if you think about it, the systems that I just put on a piece of paper, and you could go to our website and see our entire process in 14 minutes. I give it away. but then I'll give you all the stocks that I'm doing. I'll show you all the stocks
I'm having to do.
I'll show you. But why I know that it's difficult is because to add to a winning position doesn't make sense to the average person. And to sell a position when it's going down doesn't make sense. And something worse than not making sense, it doesn't feel good. You just said today's a bad day. Sure, it's a bad day. We're having to sell, in some cases, we're selling at the second, third of our positions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're losing money, but we're not losing as much as we would have been if we'd been adding to them.
Correct.
And we're certainly not losing as much as we would have if we hadn't sold the first third already. So then what that does to you is you lose less on the way down and you make more on the way up. And you're choosing the cheap and expensive stocks. So you've kind of got an edge. And that edge comes out, everything I've just said to you, after 25 years, that gives you a 4% edge. You're right 54% of the time and wrong 46% of the time. But the ratio is different. You're making $3 every time you're right, and you're losing a dollar every time you're wrong. And that's what leads to the 50 to 20% per annum returns.
And I think that's what people neglect when they talk about running a share portfolio, and is that it's so hard to generate alpha. It's so hard to be right regularly. And I just don't think at home you can just sit there and just be right because, I don't know, you felt like it. You know,
when you read a hot tip from a broker or anything like that.
Yeah.
Look, I think the thing that I've noticed, even before we get to being right or wrong, is if you've grown up in a society like, for example, Australia, or you've grown up in a community where if you get a gold star if you get 80% right, and then you're a really super duper if you get 85% right, and then if you can continue that for long enough, you get to school and then high school, and then if you really get enough gold stars, you can get to university, and then if you really can nail it, then you get 3 or 4 gold stars and you come out the other side. Now, to say to those people then, that style of a person, you're now going from gold stars to failing. Because if someone after all this time can only get 54% of them right, or something like that,
yeah,
then, or you could even make money if you're only right 45% of the time,
yeah, of course, provided
you're making more than you're losing, to say to that group of people, you're going to be more wrong than you're going to be right, it will send them out of the industry.
But that's
it why doesn't send them in the first place.
And that's why I think often, you know, I'm not an academic by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I'm just a dodgy salesman.
You got your master's?
Yeah, okay, yeah, I'm qualified enough, I'm smart enough, you know, I can do the work. But I think that the idea that if the smartest was just the winner, if it was just a game of being the smartest, it'd be so much simpler and easier. But it's not, and therefore it doesn't result in the smartest people always winning.
So the room kind of splits into when I do my presentations. The first four slides go, you know, we're looking for stocks on a PEG ratio where the PE might be 10 and growing at 20% per annum, 8 to 10% operating cash flow yield, 6 to 8% free cash flow yield, cash
and voucher, and no debt.
We're all looking for that.
Yeah,
on the other side, we're looking for ones on 10% EPS growth growing that are on a PE of 20 with no operating cash flow, no free cash flow, lots of debt.
Mm-hmm.
We're all looking for that. So here's the thing. If we're all buying low and selling high, how come we aren't all outperforming the index?
Got to be buying off somebody.
And the thing also is that then you come to the second component of this, is when to buy, when it's finished falling and going back up, and when to sell. That's the hard thing now, right? When to sell when it rolls over and goes back down. I mean, I actually do sympathize a lot with the general public who open the Fin Review.
First mistake.
Read 25% of everything they read is about the banks.
Yeah.
Which is about what? 15% of the index?
Yeah.
18, you know, if you include a few incidentals, probably 18% of the index, 20% of the index. And so when you improve companies that, you know, service the banks.
Yeah.
So now here we are trying to work out what the banks are going to do. So the banks have gone nowhere in 2 years, nowhere in 5 years, and nowhere in 10 years.
And they're 94% correlated.
And
it doesn't matter which one you own.
PE of 14, growing at 3 to 4% per annum. I can't tell you where they're going to go next, right? So, how does everyone do it? That we've all just got to throw a dart at the dartboard and just see where we end up.
Yeah.
What I can say about that, though, and this is particularly relevant for the new fund, is they tend to work in a pattern. They go down $20 to $30, and then they go up $20 to $30. Then they go down $20 to $30. They go up $20 to $30. Nothing to do with how the thing's earning on the day or what the reporting was.
Just like
was
the or yield support like, or the well, and for now technical
we
support.
Just had massive negativity around a Haynes report, vertical integration problems, horizontal integration problems, non-servicing of service fees, blah blah. Yeah, I mean, I don't have to tell you this goes on and on and on and on, and we get to a point of maximum pessimism. And then we can start to recover. And so that happens with every single sector. Remember, there would have been a time, maybe not in our little recent investing histories, where gold was so cheap you didn't dig it out the ground. Then it becomes so valuable that you dig deep, deep, deep under the ground to get it.
Yeah.
And then you get to a point where the world becomes so risky, you take all your gold and you bury it again. So after you've dug it all up, you bury it again for after the war, and then you can take it back out again, or after the whatever, or you can put it in a vault. Things just go, everything just goes in cycles.
Very true, very true. What's different about the new fund versus the old fund?
So we've been doing this now for 15 years, right, in the listed vehicle, and we've managed to outperform the market by two and a bit times, nearly 2.5 times what the market's
done. If you haven't looked at Carl's returns, go look at his returns over 13 or 14 years. Very, very impressive, you know, before you sort of get deep in this podcast, worth listening to.
Yeah, and then what we do, maybe a bit different to other people, is once we've earned that money, we pay tax on it and we pay it out to you as a fully franked dividend. So we've got a lot of self-managed super funds. A lot of people use that money. They get the franking back, and that's part of their investment and superannuated retirement regime.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, this is all great, the things that I'm describing to you in 15 minutes, that happens over 2 to 7 years. Right? These are long time frames. Macquarie has been in the portfolio 5 years. At the end of all of this, when something goes from 3 times cash flow to 15 times cash flow, and it's no longer that cheap, then we get a different pattern formation. We start to get big moves, big gyrations, big change in volatility. And that in itself creates opportunity. That's the world that I thought a year ago we'd be living in, and we've started to live in it a bit sooner than I thought.
Yeah.
Which actually, if I had my timing slightly better, I would have raised the money slightly sooner so that I could have already been benefiting from this type of environment. Now, let's go to Macquarie. Macquarie's been trading a range 111 to 127, 112 to 128, 113 to 130. Been trading these $15 ranges. They are big moves, right? That's a 15% move in the stock. And then it ends the year up 10%. So there's actually more movements inside the long-term trend than there is the long-term trend.
Yeah.
That's been happening in base metals a lot. It's been happening in the banks I just described. It's been happening for 10, 15 years. It's been happening more recently in some of the industrial stocks.
We tend
to think we're going to see more of this. There's going to be much more volatility, and there's an opportunity to make money in these trends from 6 to 18 months.
Which kind of makes a lot of sense if you think about where we are sort of in the larger macroeconomic cycle, the longer term cycles of the world. I think that we're in that sort of late phase, we started that late phase, and you know, we might have another 18 months or two years to run. I think this is probably the first of maybe one or two more of these kind of significant corrections we'll have over the next couple of years. And I think as consumption picks up and interest rates pick up and, you know, inflation's picking up, you know, some companies are going to really benefit from that,
yep.
But other companies aren't going to benefit as much, and that's kind of going to where you'll see dispersion and new opportunities.
Yeah, and I've been saying going around to people, because it's a funny time to be raising money at the moment. People are very, very nervous. So I can say in the 25 years I've been running money, I've seen 8 bear markets and 8 bull markets. And in the next 25 years, I'm going to see 8 bear markets and 8 bull markets. In the listed space I've been doing 15 years, I've seen 5 bear markets, 5 bull markets. In the next 15 years, we're going to see 5 bear markets, 5 bull markets. And in between all of that, the same patterns that I've outlined are just going to repeat themselves over and over and over again. Things are going to get really expensive and then really cheap, and then we'll wonder why we were paying 100 times PE for that, and then we'll wonder every 10 years
just on the large.
It'll be even things like, let's say the fangs. Mm-hmm. We just all hear about,
you're
going
to hurt me, Carl, you're going to hurt my feelings.
But one day the earnings growth on the fangs are going to slow,
uh-huh.
And on that day their PEs are going to contract.
Of course.
That's the nature of the beast. Then there's going to be some new things, the ANGs or the IANGs or the artificial intelligent ANGs or whatever. Yeah. They'll all be just doing these massive growth spurts, and then there'll come a phase when they make money, and then there'll be a phase when it all ends again.
Yeah.
In those phases, there'll be when Facebook on the way up was on 40% EPS growth on a PE of 20 at one stage, from $95 to $195 we owned it. Right? So it fitted our profile for a number of years. Visa fitted our profile for a number of years. Samsung fitted our profile for a number of years. Actual fact, Google and Apple, if they fall enough, might actually meet the profile criteria.
Yeah.
So it'll just, this thing just keeps repeating itself over and over again. And you can tell how, when I describe these thematics to you, how difficult it is to be right more than 50% of the time.
Definitely.
Because who knows what the future holds, but definitely I know what we'll be doing, and we'll be doing those things that meet our criteria in that phase.
You know what's it's interesting, like what you said then about Facebook. Like, I think what happens is people see that opportunity, 40% EPS growth 20 times, and they buy it, and the smart people buy it the first time. They see it the first time because they've been looking for that stuff for a long time, and when they see it, they know that they should own it. I think the problems come when people try and do the same trick on the other side of the trend, which is essentially after it's already run, it's caught up, the PE's caught up, the earnings have grown for a few years.
But that's, I have never had so many questions about something I know nothing about as last year on Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Okay, so as I understand, if I have a $10 note in my hand, the $10 is not the note, it's what the Reserve Bank says they'll give me in gold if everything turns ultra pear shaped.
Yeah.
That's how it used to be. Right?
Not anymore. Yeah.
But now, if I've got a Bitcoin in my hand, I think it's the same deal. I kind of got nothing. But I'm not sure. I don't know much about Bitcoin. But what I do know is when everybody was asking me about Bitcoin and it had already run so hard, it was only logically in the way markets work, mm-hmm. from a cadence perspective, there's only one way it was going, and that was back down. And we're watching that now. And it makes what the paper once a week, and everyone goes, Bitcoin's fallen another 20%. It's just going on and on and on. And so it'll be when the taxi drivers are asking me about whatever stock it's going to be that everyone's reading about in the paper, that'll be starting to mark the end.
I've got a very guaranteed way to make money, Carl, 100% proof so far. The Janelle Larity of my mum, stock market index. I know we're at the top of the market when my mum starts asking me about the stock market.
Because she's that's been,
my,
yeah.
And, she's, and you said one for the bottom of the
to
market.
Be fair, Janelle, your mother, it's because she's reading the paper and staying informed.
And she's a real estate agent. She's at the Home Open on the Saturdays.
Yeah.
People are talking about stocks. It's popular. It's trendy.
All the Bitcoin millionaires are buying houses.
Our resident Bitcoin millionaire.
Who's talking to you about Teva? Teva Pharmaceuticals. Nobody.
Nobody except Mayne Pharma shareholders.
Yeah, it's Mayne Pharma who bought it off Teva and then watched their stock implode.
Exactly.
So, but we own Teva.
Yeah, I know you do. You own that since six months ago.
Yeah, Teva's on an 8x PE. It's the biggest turnaround I've ever been involved in. They're cutting out $3 billion of debt a year. I mean, sorry, $3 billion of earnings a year. They've paid down debt by $8 billion. Their stock price went from $75 to $10 and is now $20. What did I say to you about a perfect turnaround? You give the first 100% to someone else and then you start buying it. We think it'll go to $45. And it's got, and it, whenever I talk about the stock, people go, I hate it.
I've looked at it after I spoke to you last time.
Because they've dropped, the fund managers who've been in the stock dropped $35 billion between them. They're going to be more. They're going to be what you call emotionally, mortally scarred emotionally. You know.
Yeah, it's done. Yeah. Blacklisted.
So, and when you start hearing about Teva, and when everyone's talking about it, when it's up 120%, you'll think, "What's Cadence doing?" Well, I'll be long because I won't have been allowed to sell it on the way up. But then, when it all does eventually roll over, we'll have sold it and we'll be looking for the next one. I mean, the whole problem with our process is you've just got to be out there doing it for long periods of time to find the opportunities. That's the problem. So. I think that a mom and dad investor could do it. They'd have to have a different system where they only look at things in the morning and only look at it in the evening, and then look for that same process as we do, but they wouldn't capture as many of the opportunities. But they still might do okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's no limits on information anymore. You know, everyone's got the same intel, right?
It's not the information.
It's what you do with it.
With a phone sitting on the desk here, it's so much noise. But no one's telling, and this is what I ever, when I'm interviewing people that come want to get a job with us, no one's telling them not to buy a falling stock. And no one's telling them not to sell a stock that's going up. Because if all these bits of noise had at the end of the sentence, we've just told you all this amazing story about the show, the stock on CNN, but bear in mind it's falling, so don't buy it. Or we've just told you all this incredible stuff, but bear in mind it's making new highs, so don't short it.
So how do you go, Carl, in those markets where stocks are making 52-week high after 52-week high. Momentum's so strong as a factor.
It's hard, very hard.
Like the last 2 or 3 years,
doesn't meet our fundamental criteria. Very often can meet your technical criteria for a moment in time, and then gets whipsawed, volatile up and down. And then also in the full knowledge, if you do it, if you're going to play, you also know that when the music stops, you might be the one that doesn't get a chair.
Exactly.
Because if it's on infinity earnings and it's gone from 100 million to 100 billion. There's a good chance of going from 100 billion back to 100 million. And then that is...
You know what you want.
It's what you want if you're short.
Yeah.
Not if you're long.
I'm curious to know if you ever allow yourself to violate the rules that Cadence has in place.
The whole thing is you sit there with the morning meetings and all the portfolio managers after all of these years are giving the risk manager all these amazing excuses as to why they don't have to follow the rules this time.
Mm.
It's not the human condition to buy a rising stock and sell a falling stock. That is not the human condition. The human condition is to buy something that's falling and to sell something that's going up.
Mm-hmm.
People are constantly, your emotional side of your brain is looking for a bargain, and then the other side of the scared and nervous side of your, the neurotic side of your brain is telling you to... You never went broke. What's the saying? You
never go broke taking profits. Yeah.
You never get a five bagger selling something at a 20% profit. It never happens.
So how do you avoid worrying about the inevitable cliff that's going to ruin half your profits in a day?
It's going to happen anyway, right? So I've got I talk to quite a few people who are ultra bears, just to keep yourself, because I'm a bit glass half full, so I try and temper that a bit of the time. and then the ultra bears are always, it's going to call 50, 60, 70, 80. 90%, and the world's going to end the way we know it. Last time it was Rubini was famous for it.
Yeah.
And then I think Marcus Faber came out at the bottom of it all and said, it's finished. The only thing now is to buy some land in Queensland, grow a vegetable, and get a gun.
That's right.
Because you'll need security, you'll need to protect it, and you'll need water and vegetables to survive. And then
these are real bears, these are grizzly bears.
This is stuff that happened, right? And so the bear markets, there will be a bear market, and there'll be a bull market, and it won't happen when all these guys say it'll happen, it'll just happen when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of it, the market will go up again. You have to have a plan for it. If your plan is just to hang on to all the stocks that have no earnings, that's not going to be a good plan. If your plan is to sell at the bottom, that's not going to be a good plan. If your plan is to buy at the top, that's not going to be a good plan. If your plan is to buy when everyone else is buying, that's not a good plan. If your plan is to sell when everyone else is selling, that's not a good plan. If your plan is to get into the stock market because you've heard about it when everyone else is getting into the stock market, that's not a good plan. So none of those are good plans. The good plan.
I find only buying hurts. I find buying stocks hurts normally. I'm like, there's risk here, but the balance of probabilities tells me this is going to go my way if I get long. Mm. And I think it ticks all the boxes.
Yep.
Forget about your, we were talking about this recently. Forget about your management. Forget about your people. Forget about, just follow the numbers. Stick to your plan. Stick to your process. And sure enough, more times than not, you go okay.
I've got to say that over time, the longer I've been doing this, the one thing I'd say I'm going to proviso you on there is over time you do realize that good people can make a phenomenal difference. But it's not clear cut. You put a good person into a bad industry, nothing happens. You put a bad person into a good industry, often they do quite well too.
And it's difficult to point that out when you're meeting with them three times a year or twice a year or whatever it is.
The best thing is to find good people in a good industry.
Of course.
I mean, it's not going to be, if you could say you could put the greatest person in the world into manufacturing motor vehicles in Australia, and which are being subsidized by $23,000 per motor vehicle by the government, that's not going to work long term because we don't have economies of scale. We haven't been able to build a mass production like Geely Auto producing 2 million cars a year, or VW producing even more. Like, we don't have capacity. There's certain things that just can't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But we, here in Australia, have certain natural advantages which we can certainly take advantage of. If you, generally speaking, I mean, not that I'm in this industry at all, but if you, generally speaking, were to go into the education industry in Australia to give people high quality educations from around the world in a secure environment that has transparent regulations and operates in a fair and reasonable manner, well, Australia's a pretty good starting point for that style of a business. So that you do, there are certain areas where we have a natural advantage and certain areas where we have a natural disadvantage, and probably in other countries it'll be
the other way around. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
it's always interesting. I find people don't worry so much about the sector. They think, oh, it's a good that company is doing well, it's the share price is going up, the earnings are going up, or whatever it might be. But I think you're right, there's always an environment with which one must operate, and you're often part of it is the nurture, I suppose, the individual, the small company, whatever it might be. But then there's an element of, well, this could just be a good growth sector, and we should own a couple of things in here.
Well, let's just go back to that gold example, because I mean, it's very extreme, right?
Yeah.
If you're trying to mine gold out of the ground when it's $200 an ounce and it's costing you $400 an ounce to get out of the ground, that will clearly lead to you losing $200 per ounce. If you try to mine gold when gold is $1,000 an ounce and it costs $400 to get out of the ground, you will clearly make roughly $400 an ounce. Now, both of them are in the gold industry. Both of them could have had a good manager running the mine.
Yep.
The only difference is at that stage, the price was anywhere $200 at one stage and $1,000 at another stage. So even within certain industries, they're in cyclical.
Particularly commodities.
By their nature.
And they're highly cyclical as well. Highly, highly cyclical.
And that's the thing, that we have so much of natural resource here in Australia. And we've just got to realize that commodities are the purest form of trading in the world, demand supply driven, and resources are just a leveraged version of that, like about three or four times as leveraged as the underlying commodity price.
Mm. So what's in the Cadence portfolio at the moment? What stocks do you like, and how are you seeing this recent kind of pullback?
Look, I find this Teva situation really interesting. The guy's coming, he's getting paid $30 million to turn it around. He's a really well-known, hard-nosed pharmaceutical guy. It's a dual-listed US-Israeli company, but they brought in a Scandinavian to run it. The reason they've done that is because no one local could have done what needed to be done. They went to the High Court of Israel to get permission to fire 15,000 people.
Jeez.
They're closing down 60% of operations, and they sold 10% of their bottom products, which were losing money, and Mayne Pharma bought some of them. Now, that turnaround is going to save $3 billion of costs per annum, and they've reduced their debt by nearly $8 billion so far this year, And so when we get to the stage where their debt is manageable, they're at $22 billion, if they pay off another $7 or $8 million, that's going to be a manageable number. That is what's going to cause the equity value to go up so much.
Because the quality sort of dials up a touch.
And the quality of the business will be different. It'll be a massively turn. And the turnarounds don't go in a straight line. They take time, but that's happening. You've heard me talk about Macquarie. Macquarie's been great. It's just had two upgrades. I call them these are my double jeopardy upgrade stocks. They've had two upgrades in the last 3 months and they're down. So Macquarie's just had an upgrade and a quasi upgrade.
Yep.
And they're down 10 or 15%. Teva's had two upgrades in the last 3 months and they're down 10 or 15%. The big one, Emeco, has had an upgrade and affirmed its utilization numbers at the AGM.
And screening really
they're off 20 something percent.
Yeah. Right?
So think about the and you know, we've had to in Macquarie sell a third. Teva hasn't come up to sell a third yet. Macquarie might be having to sell another third. They become quite you know, like you have to make big decisions on these things.
Yeah.
But they are good quality stocks. And Noni B's just had an upgrade. It's down. Yeah, there you go. Any upgrade. It's only had one upgrade though in the last 2 months. It had a really good result. But it's cheap.
But earnings revisions aren't testing as well at the moment as they have recently. So revisions was like the factor that you wanted to look at for the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it's just fallen off a cliff.
A stock we've done really well in, this will be our third time doing really, really well in, is the Melbourne IT, Arc.
Yeah.
And that's been, you know, we started at $1.11 in that, buying it off Malcolm Turnbull when he went into politics. That doubled and then tripled. And then they had a little earnings hiccup and it's come back to about $2.20. Now it's cheap too. Now it's got, you know, but it's in the kind of what we call the sin bin now.
Yeah, I was going to say one more.
Its year end is December.
Yeah.
So we'll get it through that year end at $38 million of EBITDA, I would say, and then we're into the new year with strong EBITDA growth, and then we're going to turn around and go, oh, this is on 7.5x EV.
Doing 10
for the style of stock. Yeah. It's quite cheaper.
What's it growing at? 10.
Well, it'll be growing more than that. More? No, much more than that. Yeah. So it's even great. Even now, it's still growing at 15%. So it'll be growing at 20%+. I think the big problem they had early on was the market come to believe they were going to do 20% per annum indefinitely.
Yeah.
And ran to that, and then they were only doing 10 or 15% for the year and then back to 20%. So it's just that it's in that phase in between, like we just said before, a bit of a sin bin until it gets those numbers at the year end.
Yeah.
And then we start to look at next year's
upgrade numbers. Cycle comes around again, and away you go.
And you know, and I think Jen, we bought into that. We were early into G8 education. You know, the government changes in the payments schedules have caused a lot of confusion in the industry and caused all the stocks to come off a lot.
A lot.
We were short G8 last year, and then we covered that short position. And interestingly enough, it started to screen on the long side on its recent announcements. So that's how much the valuation had changed. And we've put in a long position then, and we've started to add to it, and that's been going really, really well for us.
Yeah.
We had a
worried about
a few small
that one that keeps you up at night.
Well, I think the thing that's worrying me at the moment, which we've already been selling a third of, and now we're looking to sell another third of, is I might be the only person in the room thinking this at the moment, but I still think there's a little bit of global growth going on, synchronized global growth.
Ditto.
And the world is saying everything's gone bad again. And I don't think that. So I've had a lot of exploratory early stage positions, 1% positions that we've been adding to, in, so for example, Woodside, Worley, Santos, you know, things that benefiting, and which have all had to be sold a third and now sold another third. That hurts because you know that's going to cost us. But then if these things do turn and recover, they're also probably going to be one of the first things to recover.
I've just been writing today and I've written it a couple of times recently in notes. I just don't really understand why the markets are doing what they're doing right now. I understand. I can backwardly explain it. Yeah. But if I told you those same things ahead of time, I don't think necessarily you'd be too concerned about it.
The one that I do, you said, you know, lie awake thinking about when I'm on the airplane this morning flying, I'm thinking, what are some of the situations? Well, the one big one from a cadence flow point of view is we've watched interest rates fall for 30 years. And then we're going to watch interest rates go up for 30 years. So, and we might look back on this moment and go, remember when interest rates started going up? And then remember when everyone suddenly said, and they took a deep breath and then went, nothing's ever going to be the same again. Well, you know, we might get to be you know, in 10, 15 years' time, when we've got our 30-year public record or our 50-year private track record, we might say, yeah, I've seen it all. You know, we'll be having this, we're having this interview again in 30 years' time and going, well, let me tell you, all those property developers that just bought a house when they got out of university and they went up fivefold, that strategy only worked when interest rates were falling. It didn't work when interest rates were going up.
I just don't... I my sort of default position on the interest rate argument is that after the GFC, after all the work that's been done by central banks to get economies to the point they actually have inflation again, I can't see them raising rates ahead of the inflationary curve. And I see companies as the best way to get leverage to inflation. Now, obviously, you've got to choose which companies, but I think it's kind of the...
Oh, that's... you know, so for me... I'm obviously biased, but I look at it all and think, well, if interest rates are going up, you don't want to be long bonds, do you?
No.
Because they go down in value.
Of course.
If your interest rates are going up and you're long really expensive houses, you probably don't want to be there either.
Long duration assets,
and
no.
And so, and if you're going to be just long leverage, long margin loan, long equities, you probably don't want to be there either, because your marginal loan is going to cost you more and more and more and more and more. And the
and you can't cover it with a div anymore.
Compress,
because your yield's going down.
And so there's probably a portion of equities that you want to be in.
So everyone seems to want to be long financials and be long resources. That seems to be, this barbell strategy seems to be through the market, everybody's kind of go-to inflation.
Yeah, it might not, you know, we just have to see what works. I mean, traditionally,
interesting approach.
You can get insurance companies in rising interest environments can do well.
Yeah.
Provided they can get their price hikes through. It'll be the companies that can get their price hikes through that'll be important. But then come full circle to the Cadence approach. What's the point in buying something that can put price rises through if they're already trading on a 24 times PE? So you're already on a big valuation. We've got to now then go and take that thesis and start ferreting around to something that's cheap. Let me take you to a world where no one wants to look at the moment. I've got a stock called Home Loan, stock code HOM.
Yeah, I know.
It's on a PE of 8, growing at in excess of 20% per annum. The banks have said they want to stop lending money to people. They don't want to do, they only want to do pure prime loan. They don't want to do near prime. So if you run your own business and you've got a very successful business and you're a near prime client, the banks don't want you anymore. If you then look to go and get a loan, you might go to someone like a home loan who says, listen, the banks, you know, they've finished with lending you 100% on your loan. They want you to have a bit of a deposit these days.
Yeah.
So now you go across to home loans and say, listen, if you're a businessman and you've got that sort of situation and you've got 20 or 30% deposit, and you can show us exactly what you're doing, we spend a bit more time on it, we can spend time doing the due diligence on you, because we don't have head offices and offices and branches, and we do everything
in-house,
and we manufacture our own product. We do RMBS manufacturing ourselves. We do everything ourselves, and we have our own distribution platform. So it's straight through from us to the client, and we can make that 160 to 180 net interest margin, that basis points net interest margin. Now we've got a business that's growing at 20%+ per annum. So that's... And you know, we bought into that position at 50 cents. We got National Australia Bank's non-core stake after they got out of it. So you wouldn't naturally be thinking there, would you?
So what's the market cap of that?
Oh, what's the market cap of them? That'd be a couple of hundred.
A couple hundred.
So, and probably too low.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It should be higher. Yeah. So, but, and also they have clearly reiterated that they may move into more than home. Some stage of the future.
Anything they've got the brand power system to sell across the...
Yeah, they've got very, very good systems too. So interesting situations will kind of... If you're turning over enough rocks, something's going to kind of gel.
Definitely.
If you look around long enough, something always shows up. But it would appear in that environment with interest rates going up, your thesis takes you towards things that have a little bit of pricing power, and also if there's this, I keep coming back to this global synchronized growth.
Yeah.
If there's growth in the world, it's going to take you towards those things that are required in a world of growth.
Carl, what makes you feel so certainly that there is global growth continuing to move on, just like...
Oh, look, there may not be. You know, the signs that there may not be is the is the oil commentary at the moment, where demand seems to have very quickly come off. But don't forget, there's a lot of oil negotiations about to take place between now and Christmas and early into next year. So there could be a lot of game playing going on with oil. But my logic is that if you've got economies all around the world that have been through the GFC, America's recovered, China's been growing and growing has slowed, you've got the Chindia combination, you've got the South Americas, you've got Africa going from negative GDP to break-even GDP for the first time almost in history. Mm-hmm. When you combine all of those things, you get some growth. Now, and you know, the world is getting bigger and more populated, and there's just quite and consuming a lot more stuff just generally. So it feels to me like there might be just generally a story that could point you to global growth. Now, let's talk about why it might not be growth. The top 9% of the world's population by wealth, that is anyone with more than $100,000 of net wealth. If you have $100,000 of net wealth, your assets minus your liabilities is $100,000, you are in the top 9% of wealth in the world. And you control 85% of all the assets in the world. And this has just come out in the Credit Suisse Global Report. Australia has now the highest wealth per head of population in the world. The median number is the highest in the world. So what would turn you from potentially not so much global growth is if that group of people suddenly hit the brakes, then that could slow. Now, what would cause that to hit the brakes is if you've had a lot of equity in your house and you're using that to go overseas on holiday, and you go out to restaurants because you're feeling good because your super went up, and the combination of your super and your house is just making you the wealthiest people in the world.
And paid you feel share, great. And you're getting paid massive dividend from car.
Well, these are, I mean, you don't think of it in these terms, but these are amongst the wealthiest people in percentage terms in the world.
Of course.
Mm. And if they suddenly say, you know what? We're having tough times at the moment. We're not going to spend money at restaurants. We're going to stop having holidays overseas. We're not going to buy another investment property because we just found out that Johnny's investment property down the road has actually gone down 10%, not up 10%. Mm-hmm. Then that can cause things to slow. Now, that's not catastrophic, but the numbers are quite sizable when you think that they control a large portion.
So essentially a slowdown in the wealth effect as a result of sort of property prices. A slowdown in the wealth effect.
That's the two sides of my brain having that conversation. So you can see that, and so I could come out to you and say I know all the answers to all of these questions, which I don't, because that's not how we run money. Mm-hmm. But you can see how in my world, if I've sold a third of certain stocks, I don't know what's coming, and I have to maybe sell another third of stocks, I'm going to have to explain it to my shareholders. I will have lost money. Mm-hmm. And so it'll go. But I'll explain to them that I did this last time with the resources collapse. Mm-hmm. And I did it in the GFC with financial services stocks. And then I did it in industrial stocks in 2003. We had to get out of them, and just as well we did.
Yeah.
The small industrials. And this stuff will just keep repeating over and over again. Now, I don't... Let's proviso all of this. I'm thinking that it's not where don't be,
let me too bearish.
We're not in there. I'm not particularly bearish at the moment. Doesn't affect our process. How I'm feeling today, now this is important, right? How I'm feeling today emotionally about where the world is has nothing to do with what's going to happen with the fund next.
Yeah,
and that's possibly different to how I see other people run funds. If they get all bearish and they feel all negative and they feel all there's a guy I used to follow quite closely got very certain that Donald Trump wasn't going to get into power.
Mm-hmm.
And he bet his entire portfolio that way. And when it happened, that practically destroyed him. So, because he was wrong.
Yeah.
But, I mean, great guy, great thesis,
but
wrong result. Then more recently, there's been people trading the long side of gas.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been following that in the last month. They've had strong views that gas was going to go higher initially and then lower.
Mm-hmm.
And then gas spiked. Like it had a massive spike.
I'm sure.
It got cleaned up. Okay. So if you have these massive one-way bets just on the way you're feeling.
But it's just dumb. Like it's a bit silly. Like trading so heavily on a binary outcome of which you have no influence over the decision, and it's 50-50 or near enough, you know.
But you know all these things we're talking about, how we've got all these different thoughts we're having, all these two-way thoughts are creating big difference of opinion, And big difference of opinion finds itself in the marketplace with big volatility, big movements in prices. Mm-hmm. And we have that. And so that is really the market we're in now.
That's the setup.
Which is why I'm out raising money for the new fund, because I really think that that style is going to be more pronounced for the next little while than just pure trends.
See, I think your style, correct me if I'm wrong, would do well. Like a big correction for you would be okay, because you'd be selling on the way down, you know, hard probably.
What's in our existing fund, the thing that hurts is when you have just the double upgrade jeopardy. Mm-hmm. You have double upgrade and the share price is still down and I'm still selling a third and then I have to buy it back.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm now looking at the new fund, right? So the different style to capture all that alpha that I'm missing out on in my existing fund. I still believe that the existing fund will still deliver 15 to 20% returns over the long term.
It's more conservative than what you're doing with the new fund.
Yeah.
And then the new fund...
Oh, no. Actually, the irony of that is because the position sizing will be half the size in the new fund,
okay. We'll
have more positions. So I actually think overall the volatility may be about the same.
So are you going to run 50 stocks in the new fund?
Could be more.
Could be more.
With 0.5% positions, if they're becoming 0.5% positions and then you're not adding to them, could be anything up to 80 stocks. More likely to be something like 60 stocks. So and that you'd be scaling in and out of in 6 to 18 month time frames.
And for the punters at home, what's the fees and how can they get access?
Yeah, the fees are 1.25% management fee per annum. Who thinks of the bottom of the range, people that cover global stocks. And the performance fee is 15% above the zero. But if we lose money, we have to make that all up before we get another performance fee. So it's got what's called a high water mark.
High water mark, yeah.
So if we ever were to lose money, we've got to make all of that back, which is very much talking to how we think we're going to be running this new fund.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been out to talk to planners and in IFAs and broking communities and large investors and my shareholder base.
Yeah.
The prospectus is live. The general offer and priority offer. Our existing shareholders have priority offer up until this Friday. And then the general offer closes next Friday. So the prospectus is available on our website.
Fantastic.
I think you guys have got copies of the prospectus.
Yeah, with everything, yeah.
And we're just out there talking to people about it and getting them to know the fund a bit. I mean, it's not like we have got 13,500 people get our newsletter a month. We've got 8,500 shareholders. We do a quarterly webcast. We've got about 12,500 people watch that. Actually, that's not strictly speaking true. It's 8 minutes. They watch the first 3 minutes and then they fast forward to, they want to know how it's going. Then they don't want to hear the guff in the middle. Then they want to hear the outlook at the end.
Just like you, when you go through a prezo, you go there first and then skip to the bottom.
What you want at the end. And then if you're really interested, then you go back. From 2.5 to 7 minutes.
It's funny, we all do the same thing.
Yeah.
What's for people who are thinking about investing in an LIC at the moment and looking at, you know, your fund against the other funds in the market, what are the sort of two or three sort of key things you want to get across?
I think that I brought this up at my AGM to my own shareholders last week. You know, don't be too much in that trap of paying a premium to NTA for a lick.
Mm-hmm.
Even a good lick. Like we were trading at a 15% premium for a time and then what happens is that you have a bit of a wobble and then you're back at NTA.
Yeah.
And then you go to 15% premium again. And then I always say to people, try and get in at NTA. And then also work out whether you like what they do. Work out whether you actually like the process of what they're doing. And think to yourself, I'm probably going to be in this for quite a while. And I want to add to that position because it's the power of compounding over time. There's actually a little chart in our presentation that we put in this time. And I've said to people, listen, I have just kept investing. Whatever money I put money into this at the beginning, all the money I had went into this fund, and I've just kept adding to it and adding to it and adding to it and adding to it. I have 20 times that amount of money in my funds now, and it's on record that I'm putting $2 million into this new fund, which is really how we come to the big one for me. This is just for the way I invest, is unless that person's got a lot of their own money in that fund, and when I'm looking at other people's investments, when I invest in their companies, we started off talking about this, didn't we?
Yeah,
talking to people that are founders who have a lot of money in their own companies, who have a reason for being in those companies and a reason for driving it, that's alignment of interest is crucial. And I've watched this with LICs. LICs go through phases, and then it's this kind of like every man and his dog's
putting it
together,
yeah.
And then they go again, and then it comes back again, and really in the end it's going to be those, there's a few where we get that just that alignment, and that's just not LICs, that's financial services full stop.
Agreed.
You can't get
Could
alignment
not agree more.
With the financial services, then you probably haven't, you You've got half of the it is up your sleeve if you've got the alignment of interest there, because you know you don't have to go to board meetings and check the remuneration and check this report and the auditor's report and that, because you know the problem. I mean, you should be doing that anyway, but you don't have to worry as much about it, because you know if the person's a big shareholder, they're going to be doing the thing.
Yeah.
They're going to be doing the thing that makes their wealth go up the most, which is their shareholder.
And then you've just got the flip side of the coin where they do the completely wrong thing in the interest of boosting EPS and making the, you know, the market love their shares. But I think that you're right with the leaks, you know, and with investments in general, alignment, and people just do what's easy and they do what they're incentivized to do. And I think that when you've got the incentives lined up, it just makes it a whole lot easier.
And also this, I try over time to be really transparent about things.
So you are very transparent.
You can see our website, you can see what you do. You can see examples of where we got it right. You can see examples of where we got it wrong. We're just as good to show you where it went wrong as where it went right. I'm here telling you that this is not a fantastic time to be raising money, but I'm also here telling you that this is a really good time to have a pool of money to be deploying into the marketplace.
Of course.
And so, and then so what ends up happening is you get a certain group of shareholders who get that, and then you can almost unfortunately write the next chapter of this, which is then that pool of money goes in, does really well, and then everyone falls in love with the stock, and then they want to buy it at a premium.
Correct.
That tends to be the phases. And so I'd take you, if I could take you just a few moves ahead in the chess game, it's to be getting into it when it's feeling a bit, you know, it's
a bit not hard.
Feeling great.
Yeah.
Is to when you want to be putting the money in. And then down the track, hey, listen, if it's at a 15% premium, I remember being on a roadshow with Alan Kohler once. He packed stadiums and we were at a 15% premium, and I was saying to people, don't buy our shares. And they were like, oh, we know what you mean. Fund managers don't say that. You're saying buy our shares. I'm saying, no, don't buy our shares at a premium. Yeah.
It's a pleasure to have Carl in with us today. And I think that's been a pretty good little session.
It's been a whopper.
Been a whopper, has it?
Yeah.
So thanks, mate. Love having you in. Always great. A pleasure. And thanks for your time. And suggest everybody get onto the Cadence website. And if anyone wants any information on the new LIC, you can just get in contact with myself. If you've got any questions for Carl, happy to pass those on as well. JT, anything else?
As always, if you have a question for the show, we'd love to answer it. Just write in jordant@senecafs.com.au and we'll put some smart brains together and see if we can help you out.
Cool. Thanks very much, Carl.
Thanks for your time, guys.
No worries, thanks for joining us,
Carl. Bye-bye.